Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, answer zoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals.
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, I think is they're awesome.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?
Today I'll be talking to Therese Lilliehold about animals and domestic violence. We won't be going into any upsetting details. However, this is a very emotional subject involving child abuse and animal abuse, and I just want to make sure everybody is aware of that ahead of time. We will be talking about domestic violence against pets and how pets are used against children by abusers. We're going to be talking about how to protect children from online abusers and how important it is for women's shelters to be welcoming to the animal family members. Thank you for joining me in this important episode of The Deal with Animals. Would you please introduce yourself and share your pronouns?
Sure. My name is Therese Lilliehold and I live in Sweden. I'm a graduate from the University of Exeter, a Master of Anthropology, and I did my dissertation on the situation for children and companion animals who have experienced domestic abuse at home. So I have my own company. I work with a range of topics concerning humans and animals, but a large focus on that is what is called the link. So the link between violence towards humans and non-human animals. And my pronouns are she, her.
Thank you very much. So yeah, let's talk about your research. First of all, where do you do this research out of right now?
Right now, I work with many different things, but we do, I belong to an organization called Se sambandet. It means see the link in Swedish. And we sometimes apply for grants to do some research studies on different topics. So the most recent one we did was actually on animal hoarding. And before that, we did a study on the topic that abused women and children need to bring their animals to shelters for victims of abuse. And how to do this, because it's not so easy for those working there. They might be, you know, they're very knowledgeable about violence and about the reactions of humans, but it might not be animal people. So we try to focus on what do they need, what kind of knowledge do they need to be able to welcome non-human animals to the shelter, because we found that It's extremely important that as a victim of abuse, you can bring your animal. And there are pet fostering programs here as well as in other countries. And it's great if there is nothing else. But the best thing is really if you can bring your animal with you, because the relationship will be intact. So that's what we did previous to that. This.
And you find, I assume, that people will stay in a violent family situation because they can't bring their pets with them.
Absolutely, yeah. There is research from many countries, and my colleague Karin Holmberg did a study here in Sweden that showed exactly the same thing, that women, because it's not always women, but it's most often women who are victims of abuse, they will stay unless they can bring their animals to safety. So they would rather choose to stay with the abuser unless they can bring their animals. So this is a huge problem for people who experience violence.
And how does this circle round to affecting children directly?
It affects them because children, the most common thing for a child, if there is an animal in the family, is that they have a bond. It's not always like that, but it's very often like that. And an abuser who wants to, if someone abuses a child, whether it's sexually or physically, they often use their companion animal as a threat. So they will say, like, if you tell someone or if you do something, I will hurt your animal. So many children have a very strong sense that they want to protect their animals, and they will do, they will stay quiet, or they will lie, or just whatever it takes to keep their animals safe. And in case you, some, like sometimes children will be forcibly removed from a very violent situation by social services, but if the animal is left, the child will still be suffering from psychological violence. It's the child will be safe from the like physical violence, but he or she will still be suffering from the fact that the animal is still there, and they know that the animal is in danger. So this will be a very, very traumatic experience for them.
Absolutely. Yeah, you think you're getting them out of a bad situation, but emotional suffering can be almost worse than physical suffering.
It can,
especially
yes.
For a child.
Exactly, yeah. And sometimes we just look at the physical violence, but the psychological damage that you can do to a child by showing that, okay, you care about this animal, you love this animal. This animal might actually, in many cases, be the only person who has been listening. Like you often say that a child experiencing abuse will survive if just one person have been there. And we often think about humans, but in many cases, this person can actually be a cat or a dog who has actually been there with a child. And then to be removed from this person and know that this person who have protected you emotionally is still there, it's very traumatic for the child.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what can we do to help in this sort of situation? Just knowing about it, you know, supporting groups like National Link Coalition?
Yes, I think many groups, I mean, everyone who meets children in the work needs to know that this bond is, that it exists and how important it is for the child. Because a lot of times the child will meet someone who is not an animal person and won't ask questions about the animal, and they will sort of know that this is not important, but it is important for them. So I think all groups meeting children who are victims of abuse must be educated about this. And it doesn't, I mean, it does for me and many others, it does matter that the animals have a right to protection in their own right. Like, but even if you don't think that, you still need to know about this and you still need to act upon it because it's important for the child.
And what about the connection between abuse of animals in the home, maybe as an indicator of domestic violence towards the humans in the home as well?
Yeah, this is actually the strongest, if you look at the research about the link in general, the strongest indicator is that if animals are abused, children are at risk as well. So this is what me and my colleague, when we educate animal inspectors and veterinarians and social services, we try to make them understand that if they find an animal who is abused, even if they're animal people, animal inspectors, they are only, their responsibility is to act upon the animal, but they should also alert social services. And then the social services needs to know about this and how to act, because it's a very strong indicator that the children are at risk.
Yeah. And I imagine that that's not necessarily something that would come right into someone's mind if they're there just to see the animals. Again, that's their focus. They may not think, especially the children are at school or, you know, something like that, that the children might also be at risk. Although I think, is it also true that maybe people don't hide animal abuse as much as they would hide child abuse? So it might be easier to sort of suss out what's going on?
Could be. I mean, we have 21 counties in Sweden, and in one of them, every animal inspector and everyone within social services has been educated by us, and they have started to collect numbers, and they have found that they find like around 25 to 30 children each year only because animal inspectors, when they find abused animals, alert social services. And these children have not been discovered any other way, like in school or anyone alerting authorities. And it's just one count in Sweden. So if you say 25 and then we have 21 just in Sweden, it's a lot of children if you count it together. So just by simply looking into this, that when animals are abused, alerting that children might be abused, you will discover a lot of children who need help. But it's also, yeah, as you say, very hidden. A lot of people, at least here, think that a child who is beaten at home will show up with like bruises and marks, and it will be very like easy to discover. But it's not actually. It's very hidden, and there's a lot of sexual abuse and other things that you don't see this on a child. You have to really know the signs to understand what's going on.
You were mentioning earlier that veterinarians might be the first to notice animal abuse.
Hmm.
How does that come about, and what does a veterinarian do about a situation like that?
We did a project 4 years ago, and it was inspired by the Lynx Coalition in UK. I've been doing a lot of work with veterinarians in the UK, and it's because when veterinarians have a very extensive education, but they're not educated in what is called NAI, non-accidental injuries. And that's how to see that an injury is because of violence and not because of an accident or something like that. And it's not included in the education here either. So what we want is to educate veterinarians on how to discover, because it's like with children, it's not so easy to discover that an animal has been physically abused. And you might think that it's not so common, or it's very easy to spot, but it's actually not, because you will hear stories about them being in accidents, and there will be explanations and other things. And so if veterinarians are trained to sort out that an animal has actually been kicked or hit, they should also alert social services for if there are children in the family. And they don't have to have met the children or talk to them or anything like that. It's just the fact that they are children in family, because the link is so strong that they are at risk.
Yeah. And I mean, even if the abuser is not actually physically abusing the children, watching your animal get abused is a form of violence against the children as well, isn't it? You know, unfortunately, prosecution for animal abuse is pretty minimal. Mm. Even in the United States,
yeah,
even when it's a really serious case, and it's only recently that they've become more severe sentences for that sort of thing. How is that in Sweden? And is that something that you see as well?
It is definitely. We have had very low. Like if you are prosecuted for having abused a woman or a child, and you have done things to an animal as well, the prosecutor won't even mention what has been done to the animal, because the punishment is so low. So it's sort of consumed within the system. And very recently we had a new law that it's for severe animal cruelty. And we have worked really hard to sort of include psychological damage, because lots of these animals can be part of a violence towards a human, and that should be considered really grave. But the physical damage might not be. Like if you talk about horses or other sort of expensive animals, the physical violence might not be so grave, but the psychological violence is a lot. But the psychological violence is not included in our animal welfare system either, even though we know from research that animals do suffer psychologically. They can be traumatized, and it's very much alike to humans, but we're just not there. So it is a problem everywhere, I think. Animals are very much used as a way to silence children, that if you tell someone, this will happen, or do you really want this to happen? So don't tell anyone. They use as part of a threat. So and it's very effective, because children most often will have a very strong sense of wanting to protect it, the animals, because the animals actually protect the, I mean, in case of dogs, they sometimes physically do protect children, but other animals also protect them emotionally. And as I said, it could be the only one who are really there to listen. And that person, you get a very strong sense of wanting to protect that person.
The dogs do step in sometimes, don't they? They try to get in between.
Quite often, actually, yes. And it, that is one of the reasons why we wanted to do this study. And we wrote a book about how shelters here, how they must work when they bring in animals. Because it's easy, if you're not an animal person, you can think that, oh, it's just we just welcome animals. But it's not so easy, because these animals are traumatized. And when it comes to dogs, and large dogs, they can be dangerous. So you have to have a lot of safety measures, because these dogs might be in the, you know, if someone just acts a little bit strange at a shelter, they might attack. And if it's a Doberman, you don't want that. So it's a lot about safety, really, that do welcome the Doberman, but you have to do like this, because you have to think safety first for everyone, you know. So there is a lot of things you have to think about. But bringing in the animals, I think in Sweden, I think it's quite unique that we have a lot of shelters who actually welcome companion animals now. And there is such a need. Like when we go out to educate someone, like last time we did it on Tuesday, we just educated the shelter. They didn't even put out, like on the social media that we do, they just put out that we have this education and not that we welcome animals. By the weekend, that same week, they emailed us and said that our rooms are full now with dogs and cats, because there have been this women with children who have just been waiting for this opportunity to finally leave with their animals. So wow. It was just full immediately, like 3 days after. And they hadn't even put out that, like, we welcome animals. They just put out that we had this education, we are preparing, and then it was full. So there is a huge need of bringing your animals with you. But one of these dogs were aggressive, and they were so grateful that we had this education on how to keep it safe for everyone, because the dogs can go into protection mode, and that's what they do. It's perfect, but you don't want the dog to attack people.
Yes, a dog is going to see threats in a lot of places that there aren't actually threats.
Yes, because they're also traumatized. They're not just acting on protection. They are traumatized, so they will act just like humans do. If you're traumatized, you see dangers everywhere, and dogs are the same. So that's what they do.
Can we talk a little bit about online bullying as well? Because I know this also is something that you have looked at.
Yes, it's a growing problem, really, that like in grooming online, if you want pictures or films or something from a child, the person wanting this is starting to discover that if you figure out that they have an animal, and if you use that, like, I know, they used to be like, I know we have a sibling, or I can do something to your parents. It's a child's worst nightmare, really. But now they're also using, like, I know you have a rabbit, and I can do things to the rabbit unless you send me pictures or unless you do this for me. And if you tell someone, I will do it. And they will say, like, I know where you live. So the child will feel forced to do whatever the abuser wants. So it's a growing problem, really, in internet grooming and abuse of children as well.
And how do parents possibly protect their children from something that is so hidden?
Difficult, isn't it? I mean, I have children who are in the age of actually using the internet, and I talk a lot with my kids, and they know about all these kind of things, and that they always tell me that if anyone contacts them and say something like this, it's not true, and they should immediately tell me, and I will not, you know, ban them from being on this game that they love, or ban them from the computer, because I don't think that's the right way. But I think a lot of knowledge in parents today is needed, and that's quite new. I mean, parents didn't need that a short while back, but we do today. And fortunately, we do, because they will hang out in like the popular games or the apps like TikTok or whatever kids hang out. They will be there. So we need to. I think my personal idea is not to prohibit your children from being there, but really to talk to them and let them know that I know about this and tell me, you know, if anything.
That's such good advice, because yeah, children will hide that if they think that they are going to lose something.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's most, to be honest, the most important thing is that I will not prohibit you from being in this, because it's important. It's where they have friends, and it's an important, I mean, for me, I can't even understand it, but it's, for them, it's really important. So I have to respect that, but tell them like, I will not take this away from you, but I really, really want you to tell me in case anything, you know, feels wrong. So I'm not an expert on that, but that's what I do.
You're myself. A parent though, and that's
I am. Yes.
Yeah. You get a lot of experience as a parent.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's a new world that part. We used to. I mean, when I was young, we used to, like, my parents were scared if there was a car going by school looking suspicious. But today, it's really in the computer at home, so we have to be aware of that.
Yeah, that's so scary. How do you cope with that yourself? How are you doing? Because yes. I know from my personal anxieties, are off the charts when it comes to my kids. Yeah. Highly recommend, you know, therapy for everybody. But you knowing and seeing and talking about this, thinking about it probably every day, that must affect you very deeply.
It does, but I think actually for me, I do feel a little bit safer because I know about it. I think since I know about it and I talk to my kids and I check it, and I'm not an expert on this, but I think that makes me, it does make me feel safer when it comes to them. I think I would, yeah. But yeah, like, no, I think not knowing about and being naive is actually quite dangerous today, and that's sad. It's really sad. But I think, and I also don't think like prohibiting everything on the internet or not using a computer, I don't think that's the solution, because this is also what we use, and they see me using the computer all the time in my work. So if I just said I used to do other things, it would be strange. So, but really to sort of educate them in this, and I mean, I would have rather not talked about this when they were 8, but I had to, so I did it. like yeah,
you had to because they were starting to use the internet.
Exactly. Yeah. And I didn't want to completely stop that, so instead I talked to them that they should, you know, this and this exists, I'm sorry, but it does, and I really want you to tell me. I'm not going to ban you from things, but I really, really want you to tell me. So,
yeah, I've always erred on the side of probably more information for my children rather than less, even when they're younger. I just feel that if they understand why something is happening, then they're going to be a bit more compliant when I ask them to do something.
I think so. And also, like, respecting that, I mean, I can't understand their world on computer games. I really can't. I'm not a gaming person myself, so I'm really, but I have to respect that this is something that they like to do on the free time, and sort of, you know, this is what they want to do. So, but I don't want them to experience something really bad there.
Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about government policies as well. What can governments do? We've talked a lot about the nonprofit and the private sector and what's going on there, but how do government policies feed into all of this?
I think they need to do more. everywhere, because I think there is a sort of way to look into animals as some small part of animal welfare or animal protection. That's just a small issue. And what I would like is the view to be broader, like animals and humans in many cases are connected, and we have to look into both. We can't like when people say we have to first protect people who are abused. Okay, but you can't do that unless you look into the animal situation as well.
So what about animal shelters? They are very focused on the animals. Sometimes they do forget the human side of things. Mm. And especially, I know, working at a municipal shelter, when someone can just come in and drop off an animal, literally walk in, drop the leash and leave.
Mm.
And you have to take in the animal. There's no, you know, intake management process there. If you're just an open shelter, then, you know, how do they, and what do they do with a situation where someone says, you know, I need to give up my animal because it's in danger at home?
Yeah, I think it's very different. We have I have a dog shelter that I spoke to a lot, and they know about this, and they try to help the person, like do you really need to drop off the dog, or is there any other solution? But it's again all about knowledge, because some animal shelters won't know about this. And it's the same, even if we have, like I said, in Sweden, we have shelters, not everywhere, but we have quite a lot of shelters now who do accept dogs. But the police and the social services don't always know about it. So if a woman will call, they might get an answer that you have to give up your dog, even though there is a shelter who would actually accept them. So it's, I think this is the same with animal shelters, that they don't always know about these things. And of course, bringing in the animals is better than, you know, putting it to sleep or something. But we really also focus on the relationship when we talk about this, because there is a danger, even if it's just a short time. If you're traumatized and you leave your animals and you're apart from it for a while, there is a danger to the bond that you have with the animal. So in case it's possible, it's always better to be continually with the animal, especially for children, but also for grown women. It's better.
And you mean that the bond with that animal will be broken and that support system won't be there anymore?
It can, yes, it can. And especially when it comes to trauma, it's tricky. So if you're separated from your animal, you might also, like in a pet fostering program, which again might be the best solution in the lack of something else, but if you see that animal's thriving somewhere, or you think it's thriving somewhere, you might think that it's better off without me, if you have been through abuse, first of all, before you hit, you have been through psychological abuse, so you have a lot of lack of self-esteem, and you'll probably think that you're not the best dog owner or cat owner or whatever, and then you might just give up on the relationship. Mm-hmm. but it might not be the best for the animal or the human.
That's interesting. It, you know, when I was working again at Washington Humane Society and our division that looked at abuse and neglect cases, they had a program for domestic violence issues where they would find a long-term foster or take an animal. And there was a particular shelter that was kept secret where it was, where the animals could stay.
Hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't the best situation for those animals. I remember talking to the lady who ran this division, and she was always or frequently frustrated because she would bring in an animal and it was supposed to be a very short term sort of situation so that the woman could leave the house and not have to, you know, worry about leaving the dog or cat behind. And then she wouldn't hear from that woman again, or it would take so long for that woman to get back on her feet. Or when she did, she didn't call back and didn't pick the animal up. And And it was frustrating to her because she had these limited resources and a limited space for animals that she couldn't help more people, because she'd end up having these animals in the foster system long term, which wasn't good for them either.
Of course.
And it makes me wonder now if that was what was going on, is a lot of times that they would just assume that the animal was in a better place.
Yeah, I think, I mean, not in all cases. In some cases, you really can't, you won't be able to be a good animal owner. But in many cases, I think women who have been suffering from abuse, they are so broken, and they really think about themselves as bad mothers, bad animal owners, bad everything, and just give up because they have been, yeah, suffering so much from this. So I do think it's a part of it, yeah.
Are there any other aspects of this that you think are important to share?
I think the problem with what we see here is quite global. And that is that people who work with children should always be educated on the fact that children sometimes, and in way too many cases, are abused, and what to do, how to see it, and also the animal part of it. Because I don't think it's here in Sweden, when you educate to be a teacher, you won't get any education on the numbers of children who are abused. And I don't think that's just for children. I mean, here, I think it's everywhere. And it is a problem, because if you're educated, you come as a teacher, you have a class of 30 children, which is common today, at least 3 of these children will have experienced physical abuse. Some numbers say 1 in 5 will have experience of sexual abuse. That is a lot of, that's 6 children in your class. And still you have no education how to discover and help these children, and let alone the part that they might have animals who are part of this. So I think we have a real lack of education when it comes to this. We don't really want to see that a lot of people actually are suffering. And that is a problem, because they do. So it's not going to go away just because we pretend it's not there.
And I think there's also the issue of being concerned that you're jumping to the wrong conclusion, is it, that you might break up a family, or you might cause this family pain because of even just asking the question, what's going on at home, or sending them to the, as we say, proper authorities. You know, there's so many horror stories about that sort of thing going wrong, and government agencies, and, you know, not knowing or not handling families well, that people might not want to go to the authorities because they feel like they'll make the situation worse.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, there is a lack of knowledge about money. That is another huge topic. But if you go into diagnoses like autism and things, people are sometimes misunderstood if they seek help. People misunderstand that their kids are being abused instead. So there is a huge lack of knowledge about different ways of being. And I think that this is complicated. It is, there are many parts of it, but you have to, it is a huge problem, really, that a lot of children are suffering from abuse as well. And we don't really want to see that. So the knowledge is just not there for those who would need it to help.
And that's what the link is about, isn't it? Is extending that knowledge.
Yes, it is. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just, you know, extending it and how to act and how to help. And that it is more common that we don't really want to acknowledge that it is so common, but it is everywhere. Even here, in Sweden, we banned corporal punishment like in the 70s, but still every like 10% of children are still beaten. So we have to act on that. But a lot of people won't even, you know, they're shocked when you're presented with this numbers, like it can't happen here, but it does, and we have to act upon it.
Yeah, it's assault against children, yes, whether it happens in the family or outside of the family.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So if there was a book that you would want to gift to all of the listeners, what would that be?
It would actually be Our Symphony with Animals. The subtitle is On Health, Empathy, and Our Shared Destinies. And it's written by, I'm sorry if I pronounced this wrong, but it's Aisha Akhtar. It does touch on the subject that we talked about today, but it's also about so much more. I really think it's such a good book on the bond between humans and animals. So that's the one.
Beautiful. And would you share a formative childhood memory that brought you to this work, or that demonstrates your connection with animals early on?
Yes, I think it's when I was really young, we had boxers in our family. And my first memory, I don't know how old I was, maybe 2.5, 3, something like that, was sleeping with her by the end of my parents' bed, because I didn't want to sleep in my own bed and I didn't want to sleep beside them. I wanted to sleep by the bedside with the dog. So we have a picture of me with this beautiful boxer female dog, and I just slept there every night like I was a dog, really. So
that's sweet. I wish I could have done that as a kid. I definitely would have slept on my dog's bed with him. What did that mean to you, being able to sleep next to him and you're having your parents let you do that?
It was a lot of, I can still remember the comfort that I got from her. She was an older boxer and she was, you know, really comforting, like a mother of us all. She was, in a way, a mother to everyone in the family. So yeah, I think that's what she gave us.
I wonder how common that is, because I remember having a cat that I saw as a mother as well. Mm-hmm. She was my cat mom and always seemed to be looking out for me.
Yeah, we can really do that, can't I? Like my old cat now, she's 15 and she's been here since both kids arrived. Actually, really been there for my youngest kid. She was there at the delivery and she jumped back and forth when he was born. Like it was a home birth. So she was really there. And yeah, and she's so important. She's like the second mother, really.
Yeah, it's interesting. I like I said, I wonder how many people that is true for. Because they really do become part of that. And, you know, my daughter who's 5 now, and she early on did not have the best relationship with the pets in the house. She was, you know, very handsy as a toddler and didn't seem to have a lot of natural empathy when it came to interacting with the animals. So I had to watch her pretty closely. We had baby gates up just to protect the dogs from her, not to protect her from the dogs. And now we have this cat that we adopted about a year and a half ago, and watching their relationship grow has been really lovely. In the last just couple of months, even, you know, he has started sleeping next to her and leaning on her and coming to see her in the morning and not me. And for me, it's a really different experience as well, because I'm used to all the animals gravitating towards me. You know, I'm the one who feeds them and I'm the one who does the training and you know, and it just seems like I'm the one who's doing all of that caring. And now she is doing some of that caring, and he's actually choosing to sleep or sit next to her instead of me. And it's so sweet to see that relationship start to grow.
That is amazing, isn't it? I mean, one of my sons had a little bit of problem with interacting with the cats also when he was younger, but about that age, he started to realize, and then they are so caring and they are so protective of the cats and, you know, really, I think it's if you have the possibility to have animals in your home, it's and care for them, it's really so important for kids. And they just, I mean, I can't even start to explain. I'm not going to start to explain what it means for my kids, because I'm not going to answer. Yeah, but
No, it's right. You know, people always say, I want to have a pet in the home. So to teach my children compassion or to teach them responsibility. Mm-hmm. But that's not really what it's about. It's what people say. No. But really what it's about is for the child to learn how to connect.
Mm. It is a connection, and it is, and it's also teaching him about the, I mean, all these difficult things, like we lost our dog 4 years ago, and they still talk about her and the grief and the pain. And for me as a parent, it's a lot of, you know, I have to stand there and not try to diminish the pain. Like it is real. They still grieve her, and I do as well. So it's part of life. It's painful, and but it's so important, and to have someone like our older cat that they've always been there with since the beginning, it's hugely important. But I also know the pain when she's 15, she's not gonna live forever. Mm. That pain will be huge. It's a part of life, but for me as a parent to sort of stand there and accept the pain, it's challenging, I think.
Accept the pain of losing, but also of watching our children grieve is...
Yes, it's more, I mean, I know the pain, and I know that the pain actually goes, it's bigger each time. It's not it's not like it's getting easier, but I can't even imagine when she leaves her family, but she will one day, and just be there. But for them, she's always been there. And like, as I said, for my youngest child, she was even there when he was born. Like, she was there welcoming him. She was there before the midwives, like really welcoming him. Like the first person who actually touched him before me, before anyone. It was her. She like stroked her head towards him. And that was before even I touched him. So... It's huge. It is. Yeah.
It's almost, you know, the weight of the experience is awesome, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, Therese, what do you think is the deal with animals?
I think it is that we are all connected, and that for like a long time, humans have tried to put ourselves apart from animals, non-human animals, but we are really connected, and we have to, I mean, in some ways we have been forced to look into it, like by pandemics and other things, but we really have to look into the future by like realizing that we are all completely interconnected.
With an issue like this, with child abuse, domestic violence, mm-hmm. and animal abuse, even if you haven't experienced it directly, it's emotional, because it's the pain of children and the pain of animals. Mm. And it's something that we can't turn away from, and that we all have to help with.
Yeah.
So I think the work that you're doing is amazing, and thank you for doing it. And thank you for being on the episode. That was Therese Lillehold. You can find out more about the link and Therese's work at empatia.se. That's empatia.se. If you enjoyed this episode and have any questions or comments about it, or the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com. Leave me a message. I will always read them. This is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow or review wherever you listen to your podcast, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. I'm your host, Marika Bell. Theme music was composed by Kai Stranskoff, and episodes in this series were edited by Natasha Matzart. The Deal with Animals is part of the iRoar Animal Podcast Network. What do you think is the deal with animals?